We're speaking now with Jane Souter, and she is a Republican candidate for House Seat A in District 1. And just as a point of clarification, you're not related to the current incumbent, Mark Souter, who has, strangely enough, the same last name.
Correct. I am not related to him.
Okay. Well, Jane, thanks for taking time to speak with us. Why don't we start out with an introduction to voters? Tell us a bit about your background, how long you've lived here, how you wound up here, what you consider to be some qualifications for holding this office.
Okay. Well, I'm a lifetime Republican. I am endorsed by the Bonner County Republican Central Committee, the Idaho True Conservatives, and Health Freedom Idaho. I met my husband, Steve, at Bible College, and we have been married for 37 years. We have 9 children and 14 grandchildren, with one on the way. I graduated from a K-12 Christian Academy in 1981. I'm 61 years old, and I also graduated from a 2-year Bible Institute in Dallas, Texas, with a degree in theology. Throughout the years of rearing our children, I was involved in local politics in Minnesota, Montana, and Idaho. I have been a chief election judge, a poll worker, a convention delegate for the Republican Party, and a precinct committee person in Kelso Precinct here in Bonner County. Our family has always been pro-life, and we also enjoy health freedom, having home-birthed 8 of our children. Our children are unvaccinated, except for our oldest 2, who did have a few baby shots before we figured out that that was not the right choice for our family. If elected, my aim is to represent the liberty-loving constitutional conservatives and all of the people of District 1. My platform includes protecting the children and families of Idaho, fighting to keep our First and Second Amendment rights, and stopping the flow of illegal aliens that are invading our country. I'm not aggressive, but I am assertive, and I like to work well with others.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And you kind of touched on it, but if you can articulate a little bit more, so why are you deciding to run?
Well, I felt like that the incumbent was not representing the true constitutional conservatives. I felt like a lot of times he was voting with the Democrats on a lot of issues. And so I think that the main issue for me would be that I would want to represent the constitutional conservatives in a more Republican way. And that's why I wanted them to have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you said you had a degree in geology?
Theology.
Theology. Okay.
Yes.
I thought I got that.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. The legislature typically is in session from January through March, and this year actually it made it into April. It didn't adjourn until April 10th. If elected, though, you end up representing people year-round, your constituents. So it raises the question, if you're elected, how much time will you be able to devote to your office on a weekly basis?
Well, in the first 3 months of the year, or 4 months, I would devote 100%. And I know that there's 2 ways to go about it. I understand, you know, a lot of people are the main breadwinners and they have to go back to their jobs and they're not as available to their constituents. But as being, I had been a stay-at-home mom, now I do have a little part-time job, but I think that I would be available to my constituents year-round. I would keep my phone number, my email, and everything available to them so that they could reach me. Because I think in the off time, in the 8.5, 9 months that you have, that's the time when you're formulating what's going to happen in the next session.
And hearing from your constituents about how they'd like you to take
exactly.
The position.
I love it when they call me. I really, maybe it's just because it's a new thing for me, but when my phone rings and I see a name I don't recognize, I just think, oh, I get to talk to somebody. And yeah. I find it really fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you touched on a few things, but let's go ahead and maybe dig on them a little bit more. And my question is, what do you consider the biggest issues in the House race and those issues you would like voters to weigh out as they're deciding who they're going to vote for?
Well, there are a lot of issues that I have heard from people. I've been going door to door, and I know that I think probably if I had to pick one thing, it would be border security. I think that people are concerned. They don't know what to do. They know the federal government isn't doing anything. And so I think that that's probably uppermost on their minds. But in my platform, I really do want to protect children and families. And that would include the education system, that would include the curriculums, that would it would just include things that, that matter to children and families. Lowering taxes, I think that's a big thing, and I'm really researching how that could possibly happen, where we could find a way to help people, or not help people, but to lower property taxes, whether it's by raising the homeowner exemption or doing something to lighten the burden on the taxpaying family.
Okay. Well, let's dig in on those three that you mentioned there. One being the problem with border security and illegal aliens, as you mentioned earlier. Well, how do you define that issue here as a state issue? It, obviously, it's a federal issue, but how does Idaho, how do you see Idaho playing in, or what your role in the legislature might be in maintaining border security?
Well, there are six states already that have laws in place that are actually helping them to be able to turn the illegals around and send them out of their state. They have laws in place already that will help them to say, you can't live here, you're illegal, and we're not going to allow you to stay here. Something that was discussed at the end of the session this year in Idaho was not having such attractive things for them to come for, like welfare and food and medical treatment, and just having them come and have things that most Americans don't even get those kind of entitlements. But so to take those things away and to make those not an attractant to them would be one thing. And then another thing would be to not allow them to stay and to actually deport them and have them come in the legal way, because we have laws in place already and they're not being upheld. And so I think that we need to enforce those laws, turn them around, and they come back in the legal way, because we have a way to do that. So that would be my way to keep our state sovereign. It's not fair. It would be like if you just gave the whole world a key to your house. It's just not fair to your family to have everyone have a key to your house. So that would be for me. I know it sounds harsh, but we're talking about people who are breaking the law. And we're a state that's full of law-abiding citizens, so I don't know why we're allowing thousands of people to pour in and they're not law-abiding. And not only that, but they're actually bringing crime with them, which is really hard on our law enforcement. It's hard on all the systems and all the infrastructure that we have. We're not set up for that many extra people.
Having seen some of the video of illegal migrants coming across the border, and obviously the numbers are huge, but do we have any numbers that you can cite for the number of illegal migrants that we have in the state of Idaho?
I don't have the number in the whole state.
How do you track that? And then also, if you're going to turn them back, do you mean turn them back from our state borders to
Well, first to where? We have to deal with the ones that are already inside the border. And so in my estimation, it would be cheaper to buy them a ticket home than it would be to take care of them indefinitely, because not only do you take care of one person, pretty soon it'll be their relatives and they'll start having a family. And they're already here. I have knowledge that they are already here. They're here in the Sandpoint area, and people are noticing that they're not the summertime migrant worker that we've known for decades. Because where I grew up, there were migrant workers that would just come for the summer, and everybody said they just would pick rocks and then they'd go home. But they don't go home anymore. They stay. And so what they do is they're basically dodging border patrol. They get nervous. They're not like if you run into a group of them at Walmart, they're no longer the friendly group that just says hello and they're friendly. They're unfriendly and they won't speak to you. So we're getting a different level of people that are coming. I know they're coming to work. Our agriculture system is employing them. So that's a whole nother realm of what's going on with them, is that not only are they here, they're being employed by the larger agricultural businesses. And I know it's not a popular stand to take, that I would encourage them being deported, but it's the only right thing to do for the citizens that are already here.
Well, that raises the question, who would fill those jobs with the agricultural firms?
I guess if I had to just blatantly say it, I would say it could, they could be filled. Maybe they would have to pay a higher dollar amount to fill it with Americans. But I don't think that we should, I still think the bottom line is you should not allow people to come in illegally just because a large corporation, business, dairy, whatever they are, needs employees. I don't think that's a good enough reason to break the law.
Mm-hmm. Do you favor sanctions on those employers that
get caught hiring
illegal aliens?
I know that in other states, companies pay fines, mm-hmm. and they still pay the fines because they're still getting cheaper labor. They'll pay the fines and then they just keep on employing them. So there has to be, if we're going to be a law-abiding state, we need to have a law and then we need to enforce it. So if we say, if there was a law in place where they were not allowed to employ these people and then they broke that law, well, that's more than just a little slap on the wrist fine. That would be something that should be taken care of with the law.
Okay. You mentioned education. How do you assess Idaho's current education system?
Well, you're talking to somebody who actually home educated for many years of my career as a mom, as a homeschool mom. We did use, with one of our kids out of the nine, did attend a public school and graduate. But I think that it is something where it's a sort of like a black hole. When you ask them how much money they need, it's always more. And the whole thing of the whole buildings and the upkeep needing to have levies attached for those things, I really believe that the state should be paying for the upkeep and the maintenance. I don't know the cost factor in, you know, saying, well, all new buildings. I think that if we just were able to fund those things and not put it on the taxpayers' back to do these levies continually, and we just included it in what they get. So it's right now, the figure I've heard is that each student is valued or gets an amount of $16,000 per year. That ends up being $350,000 for 20 students for one classroom. So I would think that in that amount of money, there would be the ability to maintain the buildings and pay. You know, there's so many facets to public education. There's the buildings, and that's one separate thing. Then there's the employees, that's another thing, and then there's the administration. So there's a lot of costs that have to come out of that. But I think there has to be a ceiling at some point. There has to be a ceiling where you just say, work within what you have and not keep raising it. And so that's kind of where.
So gleaning that you would like to restrict the education budget?
Well, we were talking about the one that was $1.5 billion.
Yeah, so we could segue right into that. Again, yeah. We talked about it a little bit earlier before I got on the air here. But Governor Brad Little signed a House Bill 521. That's legislation under which Idaho will spend an additional $1.5 billion over the next decade to fund building construction and maintenance for schools around the state, which have a lot of facility issues. A lot of buildings are very aged and need of repair. So my question I'm putting to the candidates, would you have supported or opposed that bill? It did get passed.
I would have supported it because I do believe it is the state's responsibility to maintain those buildings, build new if they're, you know, they'd have to have some sort of a criteria for when it's time to build a new one. I myself went to public schools that were, you know, they were in need of repair. My high school that I went to, the majority of the high school that I went to at the time was a very nice high school. But at the same time, when it came time and there were more students than would fit in the building, they would just take and put a little temporary building. We called it the temporaries. And we got just a great education in those rooms, just as we would have if we would have been inside the main building. So I know now these buildings are way out there. They're art structures, basically. You come in and there's so much wasted space and so much luxury. And I think maybe that could be tapped down and it could be a little more practical and not as expensive.
Are you seeing those kind of facilities here in District 1?
No, actually the buildings in District 1 are older. I will say that the ones I've seen and been in are older buildings that either need Well, I don't see the thing is that when you say they need replacing, then the price tag goes way up. So whether they need to be added onto or repaired, I know a lot of them have, you know, issues like plumbing where they think, oh, it's easier just to start over. But I still think that there needs to be good oversight, good planning on whether or not it needs actual replacing, or because we see these old buildings that were former high schools in the early, you know, 1900s. Now they turn them into like really classy apartments or classy condos or retiree places. And so I think, well, if they could turn it into that, they could have turned it into a better school by just remodeling it.
Okay. Well, I do have some questions about a bunch of bills that came up this year and how you might have voted on those. But before we get into those, were there any other issues that you wanted to pull out to make sure that you mentioned?
I can't think of any, no. Some of the ones that you mentioned earlier were like the teacher carry one. I think that's really important that they have that ability.
Yeah, so that is House Bill 415. It's concerning concealed guns in schools. This came up before the legislature. And it would allow public school employees with concealed weapon permits to bring concealed firearms onto school grounds. Right now, actually, on a district-by-district basis, the district can decide to allow that. But this would be a statewide sanction of that, which would allow teachers to do this in any of the districts. The House passed that bill, but it didn't get it out of the State Senate Affairs Committee. The Senate had a second bill aimed at replacing the House bill that would allow local entities to impose stricter firearm requirements if they were going to allow carry in the schools. That was referred again to the State Senate Affairs Committee. Didn't get out into the floor for a vote. Good chance these might come up again in the next legislative session. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand generally on the idea of teachers or school staff carrying concealed guns?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I think they could be really tactfully carrying their guns so the kids didn't even know that they had a gun on them. That would be the ideal, that I would think would be what they would want to bring across, is not having it be a huge public deal. It's pretty natural in Idaho for people to carry, so I don't think that teachers carrying is going to be anything unusual. And I think if children knew that their I feel personally like when I walk into a grocery store and I see someone open carrying, I feel safer. And so I think that if kids knew, oh, my teacher carries, no big deal. It just isn't a big deal. But I think that it's smart, and I think that that's who should be armed, because if something happens in a classroom, that teacher doesn't have to go hide in a closet or behind a door. She or he, they're ready, and they're trained. And I do think they should be properly trained and well trained.
So you would be in favor generally of allowing concealed carry in the schools, but with training?
Well, there is something called, I don't know if they have it here, but when I lived in Latah County, the Moscow police had a class called Citizens Academy. And you could go to that class, and I can't remember how lengthy it was, maybe 3 or 4 months, once a week or something like that. But we went to that class, and it gave, there were videos, we talked, and the officers that ran the class just gave us that inside scoop on what to do in situations like that. And then at the very end of the whole academy, we went out on the field and we actually did a training day. And that really helped me not only get comfortable with my gun, but just to understand the issues that are out there and what could happen and to be ready.
We're going to run out of time before you know it here. We only got a couple minutes left. I'll squeeze in one or two more questions. So there was a bill, Senate Bill 1240, on private militias. It would eliminate Idaho's constitutional prohibition on private militias. Senate Bill 1240 would have eliminated that prohibition. I don't think this is actually enforced anywhere around the state anyways, mm-hmm. but it went to the State Senate Affairs Committee, didn't make it out of that committee once again, might come up again in the future. Where would you be on private militias?
Well, I believe it was a private militia group who protected downtown Coeur d'Alene when we had all those problems a few years ago. I don't have any problem with them as long as they're not usurping authority of our own military. I think they could be well used in emergency situations. If they're, I don't know what the regulations would have been on them, or if they would have lifted all regulations. I'm really not sure what that bill, I'm not familiar with that bill, but I don't see that militias are a bad thing if if they're just going to enhance the ability for, if there was a real emergency, as in downtown Coeur d'Alene, where they could help.
Well, was downtown Coeur d'Alene an emergency? Because as I understand it, there was a report that Antifa vans were coming, but they never actually materialized.
I think business owners probably really appreciated knowing that there were armed citizens able to take care of it if it did erupt. So there's always that possibility.
Well, we're already at our 20 minutes plus here. Anything else that you want to mention before we sign off? I do want to ask, how can voters find out more about you?
Sure. Well, they can just go to janesauterforidaho.com. I have some of my forum videos there, and I have my platform, and they can just get to know me as a person, as a candidate. And I just would appreciate their vote if they want to vote on May 21st, or if they already did. I just would really appreciate their vote.
Okay. Well, Jane Sauter, Republican candidate for House seat 8, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
You're welcome.